Okay, thank you, Eric. So this is slightly intimidating, I have to say, because, you know, I'm definitely a particle physicist. I'm not an earth scientist. And the talk is kind of the interface, and there's plenty of introductory material on earth sciences. And I know that this department, you know, I usually give this talk in a place which is a plain physics department, so no one knows anything about this stuff. And so I can say whatever I want. I am more concerned because I know that some of you are actually earth scientists or atmospheric scientists. So bear with me. This is really a particle physicist view of this kind of things. And so, you know, that's we'll see how it goes. But also, I suspect that many people here are not earth scientists, and so it may be good to give a sort of refresher of what is the structure of the Earth, how we think the Earth works, or at least what is the structure of the Earth on the inside. And I should start by saying, actually, that the inside of the Earth, for people who know nothing about this stuff, at first order, we know very, very little about this. In fact, we know much better what's inside the sun than what's inside the Earth. I was actually talking to the students like 10 minutes ago, until 10 minutes ago, and I was just saying that, well, you know, we can predict the flux of neutrinos coming out of the sun with incredible precision. That is to say, we know how to calculate lots of the nuclear fusion reactions inside the sun, and surprisingly, we just get it right. What's inside the Earth is substantially more questionable. We just don't know much about it. Nevertheless, this is a little sketch or a little cartoon of it, and from mainly from seismic data, and I'll get back to this thing, right? But essentially from doing tomography using seismic waves and essentially using the fact that there's earthquakes sometimes on the other side of the Earth, we know the following things. We know that there is a core that is inside here. And in fact, we know that there is that there are two parts of the core, some solid inner core and some outer core, which is behaves like a fluid. So there it is here. Then there is a mantle that composes that essentially accounts for most of the mass of our planet. And then there is a very, very thin crust that you can see here. And then, of course, there's the atmosphere outside of this, okay? So if I now go a little bit closer to some interesting region, that is the region that is in the middle of the oceans, and there is typically a mid-oceanic ridge that is essentially a chain of volcanoes. And this is where the part of the mantle, this is the mantle in this thing, and this is not to scale, the core should be smaller, but in the cartoon, this is the way it is. There is convection in this mantle, and the convection brings material up, and then it pushes it out through the ridge, and then it sort of moves out towards the continent, and this dynamics is has lots to do with, of course, how continents are moving around, but also how you transport heat from inside the Earth out to the surface. The mantle appears to convect, even if it is sort of a solid. And so, as I said, this is responsible for plate tectonics, earthquakes, and essentially much of the behavior of the planet as we see it. The oceanic crust, that is the little thin skin in the ocean, is actually renewed continuously with this mantle material gets you know, pushed out, and then it sort of spreads out. And then it dives near the trenches, near the continent, and so it keeps recycling with this sort of convection cell. All right, so having said, this is the cartoonish view of this stuff, at least as far as a particle physicist is concerned. Then I found actually a really cute quotation from a famous earth scientist. And actually, he wrote this in a paper, in a scientific paper. Readers should take warning that ordinary language undergoes modification at high pressure when applied to the interior of the Earth. Examples: certain, the high pressure form, becomes dubious, undoubtedly becomes perhaps, positive proof is vague suggestion, and so on and so forth, right? Pure iron, actually, this is maybe more interesting. Pure iron, uncertain mixtures of all elements. Now, I was actually explained that today that the core of the Earth is definitely pure iron, or at least iron nickel, and there is a little bit of something else, but it's not a mixture of all elements. And so this is, he was probably overstating the point a little bit. But this is to say that this is really difficult stuff, and because we don't have probes, the real issue is that we have very few probes on what's happening down there. There is actually also something else that, again, coming from the outside, I sort of concerned about, if you want, or sort of confused by. And this is that the main probe you have for all this is seismology, as I said. And of course, seismology measures the elastic properties of rocks. So that measures essentially the spring constant, the compressibility, if you want, and the density of the rocks. And so all of the structures I showed before, the fact that there's a core, that there's a mantle, outer core, inner core, and so on, come from the boundaries between regions of different elastic properties as detected by seismic waves. So, and so one has to be very careful because you assign those names, and of course, just per se, these are just boundaries between mechanical properties of materials. And then at some point you make some conjecture of what the materials may be made out of in terms of chemical composition. And now at that point you fall in love with this thing, and then you go back and say, well, okay, because the core is this thing that is made out of blah, blah, blah. But actually, strictly speaking, at least from the point of view of particle physicists, you actually don't know that. All you know is that that's the region where seismic waves propagate in a certain way, and because of other things, which are maybe softer, so there is some circumstantial evidence that that's made out of certain chemical things and so on. So there is really great interest or great need for analytical tools that allow you to actually do a chemical analysis of the various regions. And so I think that's actually what we're trying to do here. All right, so let's try to proceed a little bit. And so what is the Earth made out of, other than things with certain elastic properties? Well, okay, I guess a good guess would be that it's probably made out of the same stuff as the solar system. So you should make some sort of average on the solar system, and maybe that's about right. How do you make an average of the solar system? Well, there are meteorites. And in particular, there are those meteorites that are called chondrites that look like rocks. There's also meteorites that come down and look like a piece of iron. Those are kind of not meant, they're not thought to be the average sort of solar system. The average solar system is just little sort of pebbles like those. If you cut them in pieces, I'm not an expert of minerals or rocks and so on, but there is a structure with little crystals of different elements and different chemicals, and it sort of looks like this, like rocks. Now, what are those? Why are those rocks the average composition of the solar system? Well, actually, there is a pretty impressive piece of evidence about this, and this is this graph I'm showing here. I'm showing here the relative composition. Elemental compositions, composition of those C1 chondrites versus the composition of the solar photosphere coming from spectroscopy that's easy to do from the sun itself. And there is an amazing correlation between those two things, except for a few light elements that you see here that scatter out. But all the other elements are very nicely line up on the diagonal. So this is to say, well, except for those light elements, it seems like the photosphere of the sun is made out of the same combination of things with the same concentrations as those C1 chondrites. So that seems to be quite convincing to say that this is sort of maybe some sort of average solar system sort of concentration or composition. Now, of course, there are these outliers here, but it's not surprising that if you measure the sun, the photosphere, there's more hydrogen than elsewhere in the solar system, right? That's the entire thing is made out of hydrogen, essentially. So the light elements it's not unreasonable that the light elements near the sun are different, and so we can just say that this shows that most likely the solar system on average like carbonaceous chondrites or like this photosphere of the sun. Now, if you want to, okay, that's the average solar system. Now you have to somehow make the planet Earth form, and I guess we don't know in great detail how this happened, but you want to take all these elements with those compositions, with those concentrations, and essentially apply some corrections for how volatile those things are. In other words, when you form the planet, to what extent you expect to lose them or keep them on and so on. And so this is, I believe, you know, this is relatively complicated geochemistry, but you put all this information together and you actually get your guess for what the different layers in the Earth are made out of. And the bottom line of this complicated process that I don't even know how to describe in great detail is that the core of the Earth should be mostly iron and nickel, but in particular should have negligible concentration of uranium and thorium, and in a moment we'll see why I care about this. And I also know that by direct measurements that the uranium and thorium are 1,000 times more concentrated in the crust than in the mantle. This I can do in various ways. There are a few places, I'll talk more about this later, but in which mantle emergence. And so you can take a rock and analyze it for uranium and thorium, and then you can analyze the Earth, you know, the crust as much as you want. And so in the end, the general conclusion is that the Earth crust is ppm uranium and thorium, part per million, whereas the mantle is more like ppb, so 1,000 times lower in concentration. So the picture in terms of uranium and thorium is that we've got the core that is almost nothing. Then there's the mantle that has some particular amount. And then there is the crust, which is 1,000 times more than the mantle per unit mass, of course, right? We're talking about concentrations here. The mantle, by the way, has lots of it because it's just bigger. There's more mantle than other parts. So some of these things is done by direct sampling. And it's actually amazing how much work has been done in actually digging or drilling boreholes and actually studying decomposition, you know, as you drill down at different depths. In particular, there is this publication here that reports on 38,000 data points, that is to be boreholes. That's quite amazing, actually. And so we know the composition of the crust quite well from this kind of exploration. Now, keep in mind that the deepest borehole is about 12 kilometers, which is only 2 per mil of the Earth radius. So boreholes, for the most part, just measure the crust. Boreholes, in some places, do measure the mantle, and particularly the ones in the ocean, since the oceanic crust is thinner, they can actually start measuring the mantle. But essentially, the boreholes are just scratching the surface, literally. They're just measuring the skin of the Earth. They don't really tell us much about what happens deep there. There's some other interesting kind of facts that you can guess from this thing. First of all, well, guess what? Most of the studies have been done in North America, Europe, and Japan, or, you know, some part of Asia. But the southern hemisphere is substantially less well sampled, so one knows much less about, you know, how to average things here. There's also some really cute things that you can see. There are those lines of holes. Those are, I believe, very clever ways of, you know, the idea is that you want to take a cross-section of the mid-ocean ridge, and so you go in a campaign with a ship and you keep drilling across, and so you can get the profile there. So this was actually, I imagine, you know, again, I'm very ignorant of those things, but imagine this is amazing work that they actually done, painstakingly try to actually put this thing together. All right, so that's actually one point of view, chemical composition of the Earth, and sampling it, but not being able to sample very deep. The other tack I want to take here comes from this unpronounceable object is there anybody from Iceland here? That's too bad, because I never, you know, I would like somebody to explain me or to hear how that's supposed to be pronounced, but that's really hard. Maybe a Swede is good. No, I don't think so. Norwegian or something is good enough for this purpose. But so, you know, this is this annoying volcano that erupted in in Iceland, what is it, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and ruined travel plans to many people. But the more, and of course, so this is sort of, but essentially what is powering plate tectonics that in turn powers volcanoes? So who's producing energy inside the Earth? Of course, you can analyze some of the energy flow or heat flow coming out of the Earth using the same boreholes that were drilled for decomposition. What you do is that you essentially measure delta T, the temperature difference between two places along the borehole, and then the material you have extracted, you measure the conductivity, the thermal conductivity of the rock in a lab, and now you write the simple equation here, and you can use delta T times C to figure out what is the heat that is coming out of the rock that was in that borehole. Now, of course, this is a very naive way of doing things because this assumes pure conduction. And although this may be true in the crust where you drill the borehole, but this is certainly not true in the mantle because the mantle convex, and in fact, and that's much more efficient in removing heat than just pure conduction. So you have to add a model for the convection, and this is actually, reality is much more complicated. But when you put all this together, you get the amount of heat coming out of the Earth is about 46 terawatts. In fact, there's other models that report somewhat of a lower power or heat rate. But this is still, this is kind of a reasonable, it's a ballpark. And let's just, I think most geophysicists would consider this a more reliable number than this one. So we'll just take this as our benchmark, 46 plus minus 3 terawatts. Just as an aside, so this is actually, if you divide by the surface area of the Earth, this is 100 milliwatts per square meter. And that's actually where the heat comes out. And in fact, actually, you see here why this is so hard. Because actually, most of the heat, the redder parts, come out of the mid-ocean ridges, which is exactly where you had those convection cells bringing things out. So you really need to understand the convection cells well if you want to do this right. They're just conduction is just a lousy way of doing this. So you need to actually model this thing properly. Just to put things in perspective, I like back of the envelope numbers and so on. And so, where is this 46 terawatt, in context with other things? So the sun. Or the Earth received from the sun 1,400 watts per square meter at the top of the atmosphere. By the time you are on the surface of the Earth, it's about 400 watts per square meter. Now, I'm sure this is higher in California than in Toronto, but more or less, that's the ballpark. And so that's the first rule of this thing, is that the heat produced in the Earth has nothing to do with the temperature. The surface temperature is just given by the sun, and has to do with the sun. And so it is actually, that explains why it's tricky to measure the heat coming out of the Earth, because, most of, if you just measure the surface temperature, that's a solar, it's a property of the sun and the orbit of the Earth, not of what's inside the Earth. The other thing, which is kind of a curious factoid, is that this is, so the Earth makes 46 terawatts. Human society requires about 15 terawatts to actually run. That is the amount of electricity plus, other forms of energy that we use sort of every day. So you can think of it, it's less than this, but it's not that much less. So for instance, you can use this, I think, to prove that you cannot build our society on geothermal energy. You can use geothermal energy and help, but to actually run our society with geothermal energy, you would have to use, to really tap 30% of the world geothermal energy, which is, much of which goes, comes out from under the ocean. So forget it. Okay, that's just it's a very simple number that has big consequences. All right, but that's actually so. These are just for curiosity. Now let's go back to our earth science kind of problem. And so this is the way the heat comes out, and who produces the heat? Well, turns out that good part of that heat is what, is essentially still coming out from, this is the heat that was produced, it's gravitational heat or gravitational energy. This is the energy of all the kind of, all the rocks that coalesce together to make the Earth. And when they fall into each other, they dissipate energy. They heat up eventually, the entire thing, but, and there's still residual heat that is coming out of that. In fact, Lord Kelvin, 150 years ago, thought that that was the only only source of heat in the Earth, and with that calculated the age of the Earth. He got it wrong, and this caused all sorts of trouble. In particular, it caused trouble to Mr. Darwin, because he ended up with an Earth which was much younger than some of the species. That's where, you know, and in Texas they still believe that. They never realized in Texas that we moved on from that, you know, from that kind of scenario. But anyway, Kelvin was meaning well, but he actually screwed up somehow. The reason he screwed up is that there is another piece, it is a big piece, which is actually radiogenic heat. And here is just conventionally divided into mantle and crust, but this is heat that is produced by radioactive stuff that is in the Earth and just decays, and so that deposits heat inside the Earth. Just incidentally, there is a little sliver here, which is actually tidal and chemical differentiation. The tidal part, this is the fact that the Earth gets massaged continuously by solar and lunar tides, and so you dissipate energy by doing that. But for the Earth, this is a tiny, tiny correction to the thing. The ratio between radiogenic heat and total heat is usually called Urey ratio, and in those models of the Earth is believed to be between 0.3 and 0.7, say around half, which is what this pie chart more or less shows. So who's producing the radiogenic heat? Well, primarily, this comes out, or at least in part, comes out of the case of the uranium and thorium chain. So what you have to do, essentially, is to find what radioactive elements exist in reasonable amount and have a long enough half-life that they're still around since the beginning of everything. That is, you know, they've been around for 10 billion years. And there aren't very many, actually, isotopes that have such long half-life. But two dominant ones, or two large ones, important ones, are uranium-238 and thorium-232. And you can see the half-lives are about half, you know, 5 billion years in one case and 15 billion years in the other case. So those are, you know, comparable to the age of the universe, essentially, the half-lives of those things. So there's plenty of primordial uranium and thorium in the Earth that they're still sort of slowly decaying away. There's also potassium-40, but since we cannot see, I'll talk more about potassium-40 later, in fact, next slide, but we are not going to worry about that because we can't see it, unfortunately. But let's see what those decay chains are. I mean, those very heavy elements have have very long decay chains. They're very unstable, essentially. So uranium-238, for instance, decays with an alpha decay into thorium, 234. And then at this point, see, this goes really fast. Once you've made the thorium, then in 24 days, boom, goes down in protactinium with a beta decay. You see, this is a beta decay. That means this emits an electron and an antineutrino in that decay there. And then the protactinium in 1 minute decays down. Again, beta decays into uranium-234. Uranium-234 lives much longer, but still very, very short-lived respect to the original uranium. Then there's many alphas that are not particularly interesting for us, other than they deposit energy, so they deposit heat. And then this led to 14 beta decays into bismuth-214, then into polonium-214, then another alpha, and then two more betas, and then another alpha, all the way down to lead-206, which is now stable. So once you get here, that's it. That's stable. The thorium chain is sort of similar, except it's got one of these kind of branches, two-branch kind of thing, and it ends up in lead-208, which is, again, stable. The important thing to realize is that in decaying through all these things, there is a bunch of, you know, a number of those steps are actually betas, and so they emit neutrinos. That's important because, and this is actually the spectrum. This is the spectrum for uranium, the uranium chain, the thorium chain in green, and then potassium-40, I told you, is another one of those things that is long-lived, sufficiently long-lived, but potassium-40 is only one step, one beta decay, and that's it, and then it goes to stable matter. And so the spectrum is much simpler, you can see it here, and it's lower energy, and so it's below this dashed line, which is the threshold of the reaction that experiments are using until now, at least, to actually detect those decays. So I cannot see potassium-40. I cannot see much of the decays of uranium and thorium. I can only see part of the decays, the highest energy part of the decays of uranium and thorium. Also, keep in mind that this is a log scale. So as you go down here, you're losing a lot, right? So most of the decays, even of uranium and thorium, are just not visible. Most of the neutrinos coming from the decays are not visible. So since neutrinos have such small cross-section for interacting, once they're produced, you know, God knows where in the middle of the Earth, they just fly out undisturbed. They don't get absorbed, and they fly out and make it to our detectors if we had detectors able to detect them. And the question is, can we actually see them? There is actually an interesting story that goes back with this thing. Neutrinos, as you may recall, were first of all invented by Pauli in the 30s, and then for a long time they were thought to be undetectable, and eventually, right after World War II, as essentially a byproduct of working on the bomb, a bunch of people led by Fred Reines actually detected them at the Savannah River nuclear reactor. So those were neutrinos, in fact, they're antineutrinos produced by the nuclear reactor, and they had one of those early scintillation detectors that they actually used to discover the neutrinos. Those days, they had no idea. And by the way, there is a question mark here because some people claim this is young Fred Reines. Other people at UC Irvine told me that now that doesn't look like Fred. So I actually don't know. I like to think that this is Fred Reines, but I'm not sure. When they were starting using those detectors, this is really hard. Those neutrinos don't interact much in your detector, and you get all sorts of other interactions that come from natural radioactivity around you. Those days, they were silly. They even painted jokes on their detectors, and maybe their paint was radioactive. I mean, nowadays, we're extremely careful how to select material. Certainly, you don't want to introduce something that has no purpose in your thing. But as you can see, this was a much, you know, it was a very sort of primitive sort of enterprise. And so, not surprisingly, Reines and company were confused. And in particular, they were confused because they were seeing lots of, you know, other interactions that they didn't understand and all that. And Reines must have talked to George Gamow and sort of complained that he had all these funny backgrounds or fake signals and so on. And so George Gamow, apparently while he was idle on the Chief, that was a train running from Santa Fe to Ann Arbor, Michigan, and it was called the board, he started thinking about this. And he said, "Dear Fred, it just occurred to me, that your background neutrinos may be just coming from high-energy beta-decaying members of the uranium and thorium families in the crust of the Earth." And then he says, "I'm on the train, so I don't have books." And, you know, those days there was no smartphones or Google or anything like this. So he said that until I get to Ann Arbor, I can't, you know, check the numbers. So what Gamow was saying is that maybe the background is actually neutrinos. It's not background, it's neutrinos themselves, but this is not the neutrinos from the reactor. These are neutrinos coming from the decay of uranium and thorium chains in the crust of the Earth. Reines was apparently very interested in this thing, and he immediately sent an email back that in those days was called Western Union. And he sent it to Dr. George Gamow of the Union at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. And he said, "Look, I checked the Book of the Planets." And actually, I'd love to know what this Book of the Planets is. But anyway, he checked the Book of the Planets. And according to the Book of the Planets, he calculated from the amount of energy, just the numbers we did before, coming out of the Earth. That is, he actually used 30 terawatts, which is remarkably close to the 44, 45, whatever I told you before. And he just calculates this thing and says, "Way too small. I can't see those neutrinos in my detector. My detector is too small. In fact, my detector is 5 orders of magnitude too small." That was about 100 kilograms, and those modern detectors are a kiloton, 1,000 tons. So those are roughly the 5 orders of magnitude. So enter the new detectors. This is one of them, and this is the Kamlan detector in Japan. It's the larger of the two detectors doing this physics at this point, and it also happens to be one I worked on, so I'm just showing this because I know it better. But the other one is very similar. These are kind of monsters. This is deep underground, about a kilometer underground, to shield cosmic radiation. There is essentially a vat that is filled with about a kiloton, 1,000 tons, of liquid scintillator, which is essentially benzene. It's kind of hairy to have a kiloton of benzene underground, but you have to be very careful, but you can do it safely. And then when the neutrinos, or actually the in this case the geological or the Earth antineutrinos traverse the benzene, for the most part nothing happens, of course. But occasionally there is one interaction, and this one interaction produces, in fact, I have a little sketch, so let me go here. The interaction that is used for these things is the antineutrino scattering of a proton producing a positron and a neutron. This is actually, so this is an inverse beta decay reaction. This is very important because those events are incredibly rare. In fact, later on I'll give you the numbers and the results, but the number you have to remember is in a kiloton you get about an event a month, okay? And an event is just a little flash of light, essentially, or actually two flashes of light, one after the other. So it's important there's two flashes of light because there's lots of stuff that makes a flash of light. But if you have two following one other after the other, it's substantially more distinctive. And so what happens is that my neutrino comes in. Sorry, I say neutrino, but I mean antineutrino. I'm just not patient enough to go through the word, to the longer word. So my antineutrino produces a positron. The positron slows down, stops, and emits two gamma rays annihilating with an electron in the material. The neutron, on the other hand, bounces around, thermalizes, and then it takes about 100 or 200 microseconds, actually about 200 microseconds to capture. When it captures on a proton, it makes a deuterium nucleus in an excited state, which then de-excites by emitting 2.2 MeV gamma. So what you really see in your detector is a flash of light from the positron slowing down and annihilating, followed 100 or 200 microseconds later by a flash of 2.2 MeV fixed energy from that gamma being captured in there. Also, while this energy is fixed, the energy of the positron remembers or is essentially a witness of the energy of the original antineutrino. So you can use to a large extent or to some extent the energy you see from the positron to reconstruct the energy of your neutrino. And so you do that by detecting all those flashes of light with about 2,000 large photomultiplier tubes. Those are photomultiplier tubes that are about this, 50 centimeter diameter, so it's about this size, and there's 2,000 of them plastered in the inside of this sort of giant beaker. Okay, and so now this reaction here has a threshold. So below a certain energy, it doesn't happen, and that energy is 1.8 MeV and is represented by this line here. That's why I said you can only see neutrinos or antineutrinos above this energy. All right, so now I'm going to pause a second and take a little break and go over what Kamlan was built for. That's important to understand the antineutrinos later. So what Kamlan was built for was to actually investigate neutrino oscillations. These are actually my neutrinos in the landscape of particle physics. Each charged lepton has a corresponding neutrino that is shown here. Neutrinos generally correspond to 25% of all elementary particles. And neutrinos are produced in many natural phenomena and in many artificial phenomena like nuclear reactors, particle accelerators, and so on. Okay? So this is actually, by now we know lots of things about neutrinos. We'd like to know much more, but we know lots of those things. And remember, I also told you that those things don't interact very much. Just to give you an idea, to put this in perspective, right? Because we're talking about neutrinos produced in the core, in the mantle of the Earth coming to the surface. Does this really make sense? Well, yeah, those neutrinos have a mean free path in lead of a third of a light year. So the Earth is tiny, tiny, tiny compared to any of this, okay? So the Earth is transpiring, neutrinos come all the way out. In fact, I had another example here that is neutrinos from a nuclear reactor. The nuclear reactors make 6 to the 10 to the 20 neutrinos per second. And if I'm sitting just outside the containment building, my body makes 3 of them per second interact. Okay? So again, it's just really, really, the cross section is really very small. In fact, actually, beta and wireless, and this implies that they're undetectable. It turns out that that's not quite true. So as neutrinos fly in space, or in vacuum, if you want, they undergo oscillations. That is to say, in fact, I want to go fast on this thing. Let me just not talk about oscillations, but just tell you that they undergo oscillations. That is to say, you start with a certain flavor of neutrino, and after some distance, you actually start detecting a different flavor. That is, you start, say, with electron neutrinos, and after some distance, you see some part of neutrinos that are tau neutrinos or mu neutrinos. Okay, and this occurs because the mass of the neutrino is non-zero, and so detecting oscillation, and you can see it here. This is the probability for an electron neutrino becoming, say, a mu neutrino over a distance L here. And you see that this thing has some amplitude. This piece here is just essentially an amplitude. And then a periodic function, sine square, where the argument contains delta times square, the mass difference between the two neutrino flavors, the distance over which the neutrino is propagated, and the energy of the neutrinos. So you can see that if the mass were to be zero, then this number would be zero. The probability would be zero. There would be no neutrino oscillations. But if you have neutrino oscillations, the oscillation, the probability or this sine function depends on the delta m square, which is a property of neutrinos, and then the distance over which I'm observing things and the energy here. So in some sense, you see that the distance and the energy are sort of degenerate. I can observe this oscillation by changing the distance or by changing the energy. So the experiment that we set to do with this experiment, with this detector, was the following. You just start with a nuclear reactor. The nuclear reactor emits lots of antineutrinos. Well, why it emits antineutrinos? Well, because what happens is that you fission a heavy nucleus, so you make two light nuclei and a bunch of neutrons. Okay? And the two nuclei you make are actually unstable, and they beta decay in order to reach stable matter. And each of those processes produces about 200 MeV, which is what you use to power your electrical grid eventually, and six antineutrinos. So each fission produces six antineutrinos. Now, you can take those two numbers, actually, and a simple exercise is to say a large power plant is about 3 gigawatt of power, and so you can divide the numbers and see that this is about 6 to 10 to the 20 neutrinos per second, which is the number I told you before. That happens because you're burning, fissioning uranium-235 for the most part, and where is the other one? And plutonium, there you go. And plutonium-239 that you're breeding in your reactor, and then you fission it. And so as function of time, you're burning your nuclear fuel, and eventually you stop, you replace the nuclear fuel, and you keep going. As you fission, you make all the six, for each fission on average, you make those six neutrinos. They have a spectrum that looks like this red line here. These are MeV. That's the spectrum of my neutrinos. The neutrino interaction cross-section in the process that I use to detect the neutrinos looks like this, like the green curve. And so if I fold those two things together, the effective spectrum, that is the spectrum I detect in my detector, has got this shape here that is, say, the combination of those two things. And this is my 1.8 MeV threshold below which neutrinos are not detected. So what I should do really, you see that now my reactor really emits, what I detect from the reactor is a continuum spectrum with many, many energies. And so even if I'm at a fixed distance, different energies will have different oscillation period in that sine square of delta m square L over E. And so I should be able to see some deformation of the spectrum to signify that there was oscillation. The detector that I described is sitting under the Japanese Alps in a place which is, that's actually a funny thing. Japan is a small island that until a few years ago was running 30% of their economy with nuclear energy or with nuclear power. And there is no rivers, or at least there's no sizable rivers in Japan. That means that you have lots of nuclear reactors, and you put them all on the beach, because that's the only way you can cool them, since there's no rivers. And since there's mountains in the middle of the island, if you go under one of those mountains, you are in the middle of a corral of more or less equidistant reactors. Now, I'm stretching the point a little bit, but that's more or less the way this works. And so when you actually look at the energy spectrum of the neutrinos measured, you see that the continuous curve that I showed you before is this thing here. And the data points have nothing to do with this curve. In fact, the data points follow this other curve here, which is a curve that includes neutrino oscillations. And in fact, I can take the ratio between the curve of the neutrinos produced by the reactor and the data points I see here, and I call that survival probability. And as function of L over E, that is essentially of E because L doesn't change, then you see that I see something that definitely oscillates. That's if you want, in fact, I was joking that we should write a paper with titled Oscillatory Behavior of Neutrino Oscillations. And so you can do some complicated fit and so on. And from that fit, you actually measure the delta m squared of the oscillation and this angle theta that gives you the strength of the oscillation. More recently, there's been another experiment done in China, actually, where they detected a much smaller deficit and a much smaller spectral deformation in the same curve. And thereby, they measured another oscillation. There's three types of neutrinos. So each oscillates in all the others. So there's actually three delta m's and three thetas, essentially, if you want. Okay? And that's actually the conclusion of this saga of this 15 years of investigation of things. We have measured the three angles that are shown here. Those are the three amplitudes of oscillations. And the two delta m's. It turns out that since one delta m is much larger than the other, I said there's three delta m's, but there's really only two, because since one is much smaller than the other, the large one is repeated twice, essentially, in this picture, okay? So these are the mass differences, and these are mixing angles, and the mass differences are shown here, and that's the end of my introduction, you know, why we build that experiment primarily. But if I now go back to the low energy part of the spectrum, in this, you know, below a couple of MeV, that's where I'm supposed to see some antineutrinos that are coming from geology, that is from the crust and mantle of the Earth. And just for reference, one could say that the very, very early idea about this was actually George Gamow. I'm not counting that. That's sort of prehistory. He was wrong anyway, sort of. But then the idea of detecting antineutrinos dates back to Mr. Eder and George Marx, actually. In the 60s. Then there was a review paper by Krauss, Glashow, and Schramm in mid-80s. And then the first experimental study of this was done with Kamlan and was published on Nature in 2005. And then the detector in Italy, about 5 years later, did their measurement. And then there's been some intermediate papers here, but then the last two results from those two groups are actually shown here. And of course, by now, there's also a great, you know, lots of literature about how to use or how to interpret those measurements. But for the time being, the measurements, this is really data-driven. The measurements are very poor in terms of quality, if you want. And so it's, you know, one should not overinterpret what you see, what one sees. It's for the case of Kamlan, and I'll talk about Borexino in a minute, but for the case of Kamlan, remember, this was built near a bunch of nuclear reactors because you wanted the signal from the nuclear reactors. So in terms of antineutrinos, in terms of geological neutrinos, there is a background from the nuclear reactors to this thing. And so you can see it here. What I'm showing is this trace here is the reactor. So this is the number of events per day that you expect in your detector as function of time. This is about 10-year lapse. This is and those are the data points. The trace here is what you expect from the reactors, and it jumps up and down because, you know, sometimes reactors go offline because they refuel and all these kind of things. In fact, in particular, when Japan was running all these reactors, they would refuel pretty much all together in the spring and in the fall because they needed most of the energy in the summer for air conditioning and for heating in the winter. So they would actually shut them down in big blocks sort of at the same time. And so that's why you get this modulation. But of course, so this is actually, this is a big background for that kind of measurement. The moment you get, and then there was the earthquake in Japan here, And then they shut down all the reactors. So you can see that, so the initial part, I hate to say this this way, but from the point of view of this measurement, that was actually, timing was just perfect. For the first several years, there was actually reactors running, and all the measurements of neutrino physics could be done that way. And then when people started saying, yeah, okay, so now we know that stuff, it'd be nice to see more geological neutrinos, bang, the reactors went off. But it happened to actually work quite well for this experiment. And so you see that by down, here there's still some reactors, but those are Korean reactors. I mean, believe it or not, Kamlan sees a little bit of neutrinos from Korean reactors, at least South Korean reactors. Okay, and so that's actually a detail of the spectrum at low energy. So that's, you should concentrate on this part of the graph here. Remember, the reactor spectrum goes all the, peaks somewhere here around 4 MeV, and it goes down to 9, it stops at 9 MeV or something. So this is really the low energy part. And what you see here is the data points. And the green profile is what is the reactor plus all the known backgrounds in your detector, because there are backgrounds for natural radioactivity and other things. And you can see that here, those bins definitely show a substantial excess of events that can only be explained if you add the geological neutrinos. In fact, I can even naively just essentially subtract from the data points the green curve, and I get those points shown here. And that's exactly the spectrum, with large fluctuations, but is the spectrum you expect to see, with where the uranium chain gives you a bump around 1.5 or 1.3 MeV, and then a long tail here extending out to 2.6. And the thorium chain only gives you the bump at low energy, and there's no and there's nothing at higher energy. So this actually, the shape fits well. Of course, the statistics is poor. Remember, you only see one event a month, okay? So this is a real tour de force to actually discriminate those. Meanwhile, in Europe or in Italy, there is another experiment that was built for a different purpose. It was actually built to observe solar neutrinos, but was still a liquid scintillator detector, about one-third of the size of Kamlan, so it's not as powerful from the point of view of statistical power, but substantially cleaner than Kamlan in terms of radioactive, in terms of backgrounds. And so it's kind of complementary, smaller statistics, but it's a cleaner measurement. And it's under some mountain in central Italy. Now, Italians really have great respect for science. And so as soon as they realized that there was going to be an experiment there, they decided to stop doing anything with reactors, so not to disturb the measurements of... And in fact, they had not built many reactors, but in fact, even the few they built, they just turned them on for a few months just to produce dangerous irradiated fuel, and then they shut them down, not to produce any electricity with them. And not to disturb the measurements. So you can see that Europe is littered with reactors all over the place. In fact, as you can see, the French have lots of them. In fact, all along the Rhone River, they have a string of reactors. But down in the center of Italy, there's nothing. Those two dots here are reactors that, again, were turned on for a few, I don't know, whether weeks or months in the 80s, and then they decided that they didn't want to have anything to do with them. And so they're kind of not here. The green dots are actually research reactors, so these are very small, and they don't really do much. And in fact, I think many of them don't even exist, or they're also turned off, so they're not really. There is actually one in Pavia somewhere here is actually running. But okay, so that's actually what Borexinos is in terms of flux. And you see exactly what I told you. The error bars are actually larger because the statistics is lower. But the Kamlan data is sitting on top of a big background from reactors and from radioactivity. And Borexino is a cleaner measurement. And, at low energy, is all dominated by the geoneutrino contribution. The geoneutrino contribution is this wave here. And this is actually what you get from their background and the faraway reactors in France and Switzerland and Germany. Okay? I didn't mention this in the other case. So the first thing you have to ask is that, so have you discovered geoneutrinos? Have you really seen them? And the answer is yes. If you remove the geoneutrinos from here, you get the fit has a probability of 6 × 10⁻⁶. In the case of Kamlan, it was 2 × 10⁻⁶. So there's no doubt we've seen them. Okay? That's been experimentally discovered. Now you've got to start using them. And you have to be very careful, as I warned you at the beginning. As you can see, the statistics is really poor. So this is, I titled my talk, The Dawn of Neutrino Geophysics. This is really, really at the beginning, and we'll need much more events, essentially, to do measurements that are really relevant for geophysics or earth sciences. Nevertheless, we can start doing this. And so this, of course, we have to, essentially, this is an inverse problem. What you do is that you see a flux, or in fact, a flux is a function of energy, essentially, or a spectral density, if you want to call it this way. And what you want to know is the sources. So these are the source, A of L is the sources. L is a vector because it's measured from the center of the Earth. And so now, of course, there is a distributed source somehow inside the Earth. And so you have to take this, if you do the integral of this thing, and then there are some other pieces which have to do with neutrino oscillations, you actually can predict the flux where you measure it. But of course, you want to do the other way around, right? So you want to invert this thing. And of course, when you invert this thing, there's lots of degeneracy because you're only, for the time being, we're only measuring two places. You would have to measure over the entire surface of the Earth, and then you can really invert the process. And I think it will take a while to actually do that. But anyway, we start with something like this. So in order to reduce the degeneracies, we need to use some models of the uranium and thorium in the Earth. And then you have to decide what it is that you want to measure and what it is that you want to assume. And over the last, since we've been doing this stuff, there's been lots of, this is a small fraction, well, I don't know, maybe this is half of the references that there are around on trying to model things in a way that is appropriate to interpret the geoneutrino data. And of course, aside from the interesting part, I mean, the interesting part is where are the sources in the mantle and of the Earth for the most part, or maybe even on the crust, but on a planetary scale, on a global scale. There is also uninteresting stuff. Say there is a uranium mine next to your detector. Well, that is producing a large background because it's or a large component of the geoneutrinos because it's a small ore body, but it's very nearby. So 1/r² sort of makes it important. And so you need to do lots of local geology very carefully. That is not particularly interesting, but then so that you can subtract that part and you can actually see the global structure of things. And so here are some maps showing this. So this is actually an events rate. And let's see whether I have a note here somewhere. These are events per, unfortunately for, events per kiloton year, okay? So you can see what I'm talking about. Even if you go under the Himalayas, where the crust is really thick, and so there's lots of crustal produced neutrinos, you are somewhere here, 60 per kiloton per year. So these are like 6 per month if you are in the Himalayas. We are more like here and here, where the flux is much smaller. So that's where those detectors are. And actually, in those regions, most of the neutrinos are actually due to the crust, not to the mantle. That would be much more interesting. It's much more interesting to look at the mantle neutrinos because that's the thing we really don't understand very well. The crust, as I mentioned, people have done all this borehole sampling and so on, so we know much more about it. So in fact, let me skip one slide here. The next thing, of course, also to see is what is the background from nuclear reactors? And this is actually when Japan was running their reactors. You see that you shouldn't do this measurement in Europe, Japan, or Eastern North America, except that's where most people are, and that's where all these things are done anyway. Sudbury is somewhere here, Kamioka is here, and Gran Sasso is here. But Gran Sasso is, again, is in Italy, which is, somewhat far from the Central Europe sort of theater there. The ideal location should be figured out by essentially plotting mantle contribution over crust plus reactor, which is essentially your background. And so if you actually plot it this way, that signal-to-noise ratio is best in the middle of the ocean, where the crust is the thinnest, and of course there's no nuclear reactors. But that's tricky to actually do the measurement there. So now that we've seen a little bit on the planet, how those models predict fluxes on the planet and so on, let's go back to the measurements. So this is actually the Borexino data. In principle, I should also be able to disentangle the ratio between thorium and uranium. Remember, thorium has this only one peak at low energy. Uranium has got both. would be better if they were really in two different places. So uranium, you know, has both a peak at low energy and a peak at high energy. But so you can actually try doing this, and you can fit this data neutrino flux for uranium versus for thorium. The units are kind of weird, these terrestrial neutrino units, which I don't particularly like, but that's the way everybody seems to report those things. And you see, and these are confidence level contours in the fit to the data. And you see the most likely point is somewhere here, very near this line. And this line is a mass ratio of 0.85, sorry, mass ratio of about 4 of thorium to uranium, which is what comes from those C1 chondritic meteorites. So the data is consistent with the chondritic meteorite sort of assumption, but it's far from being, but it's consistent with almost everything else. I mean, you can see that this is, right? So the, in terms of distinguishing thorium from uranium, I think is way too early. Same thing for Camlan. Camlan likes to show this thing as sum of the two over this ratio here. And in this case, the chondritic meteorite ratio is this vertical line. So again, you see it's very consistent, but it's consistent with lots of other things. So essentially, what people do in this thing for the time being say, okay, we don't know how to measure the ratio of uranium and thorium. We assume the number that you get from chondritic meteorite. After all, this is a ratio, which is probably right. And then we use from that ratio, we put it in the model and measure the total rate of those neutrinos. And so so here is actually a budget of all these things. If you add the crustal contribution, both local and the long distance crustal contribution, plus the mantle contribution, that is this part here, models get of the order 34 events, slightly different for Camlan because it's in a different place. And the measurements are shown here. So at first order, you see the measurements are actually right on, or they're very close to the prediction of the geological models. And then you can actually show it in a slightly different way and saying, okay, the really interesting thing is the mantle. So what is shown here is the crustal contribution and the outer skin of the mantle, this green band here. And then these are the data points. And this bean here is what is missing to make up for, you know, to go from the mantle contribution to what I measure. And so this is essentially the measurement of the mantle contribution here, okay? And this is similar, the result is similar for Camlan than Borexino, although Borexino seems to see a larger mantle contribution than Camlan, but you can see the error bars are really very, very large. So, you know, one could say that Borexino, within one sigma, has discovered that there's a mantle in the Earth, which is not worth the money that went into the experiment yet. But again, this is just a way to get started, sort of. So what comes in the future? And then I'm done. What comes in the future? The first thing that will come in the future is actually Snow Plus, right around the corner from here, or kind of. So this is down at Sudbury. Remember, in the Sudbury, in the Creighton mine in Sudbury, there was a snow detector that was a big vat full of heavy water that was used, was one of the most important evidences for neutrino oscillations from solar neutrinos. That thing has since been emptied from the heavy water, and there's been the detector has been modified to fill it up with liquid scintillator that allows to actually measure those antineutrinos from various sources, including from geological sources. So this should be able to start taking data in, I don't know, about a year or maybe a couple of years from now. The size of this detector is very similar to Camlan. It's about a kiloton. It is unfortunately in a place which is not very interesting from the point of view of geology because it's in the middle of the Canadian Shield where the crust is thick. And so it's another measurement which is mostly about crust as opposed to about mantle, which I think is what most people are interested in. A few years later, there's going to be a possibly substantially improved, a detector that will make a big difference. This is called Juno, and this is actually the next phase of the experiment. Remember I showed you before some energy spectrum with a little deformation, and that was the discovery of Theta-1-3, of one of the three neutrino oscillations, the smaller one. They are building a much bigger detector, still near Hong Kong, but in a different reactor site. This is now a 20 kiloton liquid scintillator detector. So this is like 20 times Camland, or 60 times Borexino, or 20 times Snow Plus. Okay, and this is 5 to 10 years, probably 10 years from having data. And so at that point, this will have lots of statistics. Again, it's in a place where, I mean, actually, this is in a place like Camland, where half of the solid angle is crustal, you know, continental crust, and the other half is thin oceanic crust. So it's maybe better, but it's still far from being the ideal thing. The ideal thing would be to put a detector right here. Because that's where there's no reactors and there's the least possible crustal contribution. In fact, the energy spectrum you would get for antineutrinos from this place here, according to the regular model of geophysics, looks like this. So this is actually really quite nice. There's no reactors. You only see the peak from the two peaks from the uranium and the one peak from thorium here. And this is mostly mantle contribution. So in fact, there is a plan for building such thing, although this is very challenging and it's far from being approved or anything like this. And this will be a detector of about 10 kilotons. And I say about because this is really still a sort of very preliminary idea of this thing, which can be, that is essentially tendered by some sort of barge. And then you can sink it at different places in the ocean, uses the ocean water as shielding, so it's like being underground except it's underwater. It has to withstand high pressure and all this, but would actually make the measurement, and then you run it a couple of years somewhere, then you fish it up and move it somewhere else and run it a couple of years somewhere else and so on. So whether, to what extent this is feasible and so on, I don't know, but this would be actually the real way of doing this, this kind of measurement. And then finally, before I stop, I wanna, there is a little sort of byproduct which is still relevant for the earth sciences, of our measurements, and that is answering or trying to answer the question whether there is a large nuclear reactor in the core of the Earth. Actually, let me start from the bottom of this slide. Generally, Earth scientists think this is kind of crazy, okay, for a number of reasons. But let me go through and say what it is. It is well known that over the geological history of the Earth, there has been natural reactors in various places. And there is a particular place in a place in Gabon called Oklo, and a picture of those rocks is here. And in Oklo, there was a, or there is probably still a uranium mine. And then when the French were mining uranium in there, they realized that the isotopic composition of that mine was bizarre and was nothing like they'd ever seen anywhere else. And in particular, there were elements that didn't have 10 to the 9-year half-life. They were much shorter lived. And after analyzing this thing very carefully, they realized that those were fission products. And so this was spent fuel, okay? So somebody was running a reactor there. It turns out you can date it. It's about 1 billion years ago. And, you know, there was no somebody there. There was just a natural deposit of uranium that started as a nuclear reactor. And it actually was a pulse reactor. It was very interesting. It would actually get water in there that act as moderator, would start up, and as far as I understand, the water would be driven out by heat, the reactor would shut down, and then again would start over again and so on. And it ran for, I think, millions of years with this kind of cycle back and forth. So the question is, okay, so since we've seen a nuclear reactor in the Earth, maybe there is a reactor in the core of the Earth, and that powers all sorts of stuff. And now, as I say, this is, and you know, the power is, remember, the power of the Earth total is 40-something terawatts. So so these people claim that there is a reactor between 5 and 10 terawatts in there. And of course, as I say, I think most Earth scientists think this is totally crazy. Among other things, by the way, 1 billion years ago, there was much more uranium-235 than there is now. The uranium-235 has all decayed away by now. So it's not even entirely clear to me that you can make a viable nuclear physics for this reactor. But in any case, you know, of course, the real direct way of checking this is to see whether antineutrinos are produced by this reactor. And those are antineutrinos with this broad energy spectrum that goes out to 8 or 9 MeV, like any good reactor would do. And so in our fits for all these kind of things, you can actually search for a component that is a nuclear reactor that doesn't change as the artificial reactors turn on and off and all these kind of things. And the two experiments actually set limits on this. Camland says that at 90% confidence level, there's less than 3 terawatts produced in the middle of the Earth by a reactor. And Borexino says that at 95% confidence level, there is less than 4.5 terawatts. So this is getting to the region where it's really interesting to actually eliminate for good this possibility. If there's no neutrinos, there's no reactors, that you can't get around it. So the wish list for future, now going back to the geoneutrinos, for future geoneutrino detectors is sort of here. We want larger detectors like Juno so you can get larger statistics. Multiple sites so you can start dealing better with this inverse problem that I mentioned. An oceanic site would be great because you'd like to, it's more challenging, but it would also have much better ability of measuring the mantle. You'd like to have pointing ability so that you can tell where the neutrino is coming from. That would be great. None of those, what I showed you, knows anything about direction. Just measure the total rate of neutrinos. We don't know how to do this. That doesn't mean it's impossible, but certainly we don't know how to do this. And the other wish would be to have lower thresholds so you can see potassium 40. But again, those two things, both of them, we don't know how to do that. And so that's my conclusions. This is actually the first example of applied neutrino physics. That's quite amazing, actually. I mean, this stuff is seems so esoteric, but in fact, it's got applications to some extent. Clearly, geoneutrinos have been detected both by Kamban and by Borexino, without doubt. And this also corresponds to the first, although very, very poor and sketchy, but the first real chemical analysis of the mantle of the Earth done on a global planetary scale. It's consistent with the geological models, and soon, but I wouldn't say much more than this at this point, right? I mean, this is actually, it's very, very early. SNOPLUS will soon join the club, although it's not going to be a qualitative difference. It's just going to be a quantitative difference. Juno will have, a, you know, make a qualitative difference because it's like 20 times larger, so at least the statistics part is going to be much better. But of course, a network of detectors, and particularly an oceanic one, would really advance this part, you know, this new science or this new technology. Thank you.